26 minutes past the hour on our Transcendent Tuesday together with Don Clark. Don is a biochemist, a doctor of, can I say, you're a doctor of biochemistry. Is that on your degree? Does it say biochemistry, Don?
It does.
Okay.
Yes. I have a PhD in biochemistry.
So not just chemistry, but a specific niche of chemistry.
And just because I'm from Louisiana originally, you shouldn't confuse that with a doctorate in biochemistry.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think of that. Do we need those people, doctors of bayous?
Well,
I don't know.
I think that's the same kind of degree that Jill has got.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of like a, you know, it's like an additional weekend doctor.
Probably so.
You know.
Well, Don is a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and lives in Garden Valley, Texas, where he invents wines. And he's invented, what, 30? I was on your website just a short time ago, and you've got new wines there that I didn't know about. You've been a busy biochemist.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 16.
Yeah, we got 16. 16 wines now. Mm-hmm.
So 16 total. I mean, how many did you invent?
Did we invent?
Yeah.
You created them. You wrote the recipe for them.
Yeah, we put them all together. I mean, we did everything from the fermentation all the way down to the final blending, if there was going to be blending. And we've got 16 new. Well, they're not all new, but
your white that came from the University of Florida, you didn't invent that. You just took their formula, right?
Oh, no.
Talking about Blondie here. He calls it Blondie.
Florida,
yeah.
Yeah,
I'm talking about the Blondie.
Did the hybridization to create the Blanc du Bois, which is one of our major grapes here. Mm-hmm. And we then just turned it into wine.
Ah.
Yeah, and an award-winning wine at that.
Okay.
Gold medal.
Yes. Just trying to get to the bottom of this inventing of wine, you know?
You would say you're trying to get to...
Well, I wouldn't call it inventing.
You're trying to get to the dregs of the matter in this case.
Yeah, your Texas friend calls it inventing, and he knows almost as much about wine as Carol does.
Wow, I didn't know Carol was a wine expert.
Is that a shot? I think it is. Yeah.
Well, she might think she is.
We're not here to talk about wines, though. We're going to somehow segue into Greenpeace and the environment and alternate energy sources. And the there's your favorite word again, kerfluffle. Kerfluffle, as exhibited by a letter from energy experts to Senator Mitch McConnell and Representative, McCarthy.
McCarthy.
Kevin McCarthy. Don't be like Europe. It would be stupid to go that energy route. And the stupid route he's talking about is the one that Greenpeace has been espousing since 1976 or so, when they got their act together up in British Columbia in Canada, where they were founded. And I remember Greenpeace as I think of them first for having a ship and harassing legal whaling ships, getting between the prey and the hunter, you know, and interfering with that business. And I didn't know what to think of them. I mean, I kind of have sympathy for whales. I kind of do. I think maybe they're nobler creatures, smarter creatures than we've ever given them credit for. To hunt them down just seems not wrong, but questionable. Do we still need whale oil, for example? I guess in some cultures they eat whales. I don't know what they do with whales after they get them anymore. So maybe Greenpeace had something going for them there. But they were more than that. They came from a group of protesters. I was reading a little of their history on Wikipedia here, and they were founded by a couple different groups of basically protesters over all kinds of different things, and they eventually settled on the name Greenpeace. And ever since, I've not heard of them recently until now. Are you aware of any recent history of Greenpeace, Don?
I haven't. It was obviously in the 80s when they had all of this all of their activities with the whaling industry and having their boats in front of the big whaling ships, trying to stop them from processing the whales, mm-hmm. and killing the whales. But I really haven't heard much about them since that time.
Well, I suspect they've kind of gone underground. I'm looking at this is their 2011 budget, €236.9 million. That's somewhere around $250 million. So they're not an organization to be sneezed at. They have money to do stuff with. It's how they use that money that we're concerned about. And what is the point of their activity now?
Well, I'm not sure what their focus is now, but one of the co-founders, has basically said that the leftists have hijacked the environmental movement, and their primary focus on creating narratives and stories that are designed to instill fear and guilt into the public, so that the public will send them money. So mm-hmm. I don't know if he's talking about his own organization that has been hijacked. It kind of sounds that way, from a political point of view. And now maybe they've gotten onto the climate change bandwagon. Mm-hmm. And
his name is Patrick Moore, and I looking at his history, or the organization's history, he's not mentioned as a founder, but he was a crew member on one of those boats and became highly critical of the organization by about 1986 when he left the organization, said these are different people than when I got here. They've changed. They've morphed.
Mm-hmm. But now now Moore is pretty much complaining about the environmental movement and how that is all political and left driven, and of course climate change driven, and he's saying that's all hogwash. And of course we've been talking about that for a while now, and we're going to talk about it again, I guess, this morning, that. There is certainly no climate emergency that, folks are saying, oh, my gosh, we got to do something about this, and we got to do something about it, right now. So therefore, we got to spend trillions and trillions of dollars to promote windmills and solar panels and convert over away from, in quote, fossil fuels, to these cleaner forms of energy that, are problematic from a number of standpoints, and we can get into that maybe a little bit further in the discussion. But this whole deal with, campaigns against fossil fuel, nuclear energy, and CO2 is pretty much hogwash, is what he's saying in this article. I happen to agree with him that it is a bunch of hogwash. And of course, people, the whole climate change narrative, at least from a political point of view, stemmed from these folks that were looking at CO2 levels, and we used to be around 200 parts per million CO2. Now we are around 400, and they're saying, "See, look, the CO2 levels are going up, and it looks like the temperature's going up. So there must be a correlation between CO2 and temperature, and so therefore, the CO2 is driving the temperature." Well, as it turns out, the CO2 follows temperature. So temperature goes up, you have more CO2 in the atmosphere. And the most likely explanation for that is that warmer water, doesn't hold as much carbon dioxide as colder water. And so if you can do an experiment in your own house, you take a soda pop, for example, or a carbonated beverage, and you can put that beverage in your refrigerator, and it will stay carbonated, for a longer period of time than if you just left it out on the counter And the reason for that is because CO2 is more soluble in colder fluids and colder water.
Well, you could cook it. You could heat it, and it would no longer be carbonated. That gas would escape.
It would, yeah, exactly, because CO2 is not soluble in hot water. I mean, it's not as soluble in it. So, you know, all these folks that are saying, oh, my goodness, all this, the increase in CO2 is due to the burning of fossil fuels and the cows, you know, producing too much gas. And so we've got to get rid of the cows, and we've got to get rid of the gasoline automobiles and the diesel trucks. And we got to put these windmills up all over the place. And if that's not enough, then we got to cover our acreage that we use for agriculture with these solar panels. So it's basically insanity, because if you really look at the CO2, the carbon dioxide issue, for example, you find out, and this is known science from way back, that the optimal CO2 level for optimal plant growth is 2,000 parts per million. So we really have, you know, at 400, we still really have no cause for concern that the CO2 levels are increasing. And indeed, we would have much more productive agriculture if the levels, you know, increased to, like I said, up to 2,000. And so and you can do experiments with that. You can have a chamber, or you can have a greenhouse, for example, where you pump CO2 and increase the CO2 levels. You'll find that your plant growth is going to pretty much be optimized at around the 2,000 parts per million carbon dioxide level. So as far as plants are concerned, they want more CO2 in the atmosphere. And the climate folks are pretty much saying, oh, my goodness, you know, the CO2 is driving the temperature, but it's actually the reverse. The temperature is driving the CO2. And as we've talked before, so what could be, if it's not carbon dioxide, why is the temperature rising? And the temperature isn't rising that much. It's just, you know, it's just cyclical. I mean, the temperature rises and the temperature falls, and it more closely relates to the solar activity than anything else. So the sun, you know, and we happen to be right now in an increase in the solar activity. And so we're seeing effects here in Texas. Yes, okay, we've had a pretty dry summer, and we've had pretty high temperatures, or you know, throughout the summer. Thank God it's cooling off now, but it's still dry. And you know, those temperatures that effect is probably more the effect of the increase in solar activity than any other thing, and especially with regard to man's activity creating this supposedly increase in carbon dioxide. So if the solar activity is increasing, your water is going to the water temperature, and we're in one of those phases of a little Nino, which means that the water in the Pacific is warmer than it's not. I wouldn't say usual, because we go through little Ninos and little, you know, it cools down and it warms up, and we go through these natural cycles. And, you know, they're not putting two and two together in saying that, oh, look, we're at a maximum. We're getting to the peak of the maximum sunspot activity on the sun. Therefore, the solar activity is increasing, which is warming the water, which is releasing more CO2 into the atmosphere, and causing all of these effects that we're seeing. Instead, they want to isolate on the CO2, because they can drive their agenda if we point that to the burning of the fossil fuels. And indeed, we have been cleaning up our fossil fuel, burning here in the United States tremendously. And they never mentioned that, of course, but it's places like China and India, for example, who are drastically increasing their production of dirty fossil fuel, not only production, but burning dirty fossil fuels and creating most of the air pollution around the globe. And, of course, you never hear that we're putting restrictions on either of those countries because we wouldn't want to upset them, now would we? Mm. So, anyway, it's an agenda that, Patrick Moore, you know, states, is drastically overstated, and it's the whole purpose is to generate this fear and the fear mongering, which then leads to political activism, and then shuts down the oil and gas industry so that we can produce new vehicles with, using electricity. But, oh, by the way, we don't have enough electricity to power these new battery-powered cars or vehicles. So we got to put up more windmills, which is, another major problem. And we've talked about the windmill and the solar panels and the nuclear energy before. And how nuclear energy is extremely reliable. In other words, once you start your plant, it's going until you have to shut it down to change the fuel rods, for example. Other than that, you're not dependent on cycles of the wind or cycles of the sun with regard to your solar panels are only going to produce energy when the sun is shining, and when it's cloudy.
Yeah, there's a statement to that effect in that letter that was written by the energy experts Craig Rucker, president of the Committee of Constructive Tomorrow, Kent Lastman, president of the Competitive Energy Institute, our Enterprise Institute, and others. This is the letter they wrote to Mitch McConnell. And advising that we should not go the route for Europe. This is just a brief paragraph from it, and it reads, "What I'm hearing from the eco-left is that the solution to our energy problems is more wind and solar. We just haven't done enough of it. The fact of the matter is, for every megawatt or terawatt of unreliable energy, you need to build the same amount of reliable backup source. For one, that's when the wind stops blowing and the sun stops shining. So what we're doing is probably doubling the cost of electricity generation, and then all those facilities that you built will sit idle until they're needed," which is tantamount to saying we cannot do without the energy. Economies would crumble. Societies would fall. So you're taking resources from a reliable system, creating an unreliable system, but you still need the reliable system, thereby doubling the cost and hampering the whole game here.
Yes, it's another example of the leftists' insanity to promote their agenda that doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Well, here's a core question for you, Don. You're a scientist. Can you fight bad politics with science? I mean, or is it like apples and oranges? They don't mix, because science is sometimes used to advance a political end, regardless of the validity of the science.
Oh, yes. And then the IPCC, of course, is not a scientific organization. It has nothing to do with science. It's a political organization to promote the climate change agenda. And so you can have thousands, and there have been thousands of scientists that have signed petitions saying this is all hogwash. But of course, the media does not promote that, does not pick up that story. They pick up these other stories that show and say, "Hey, you see, the IPCC is saying that, oh my goodness, the CO2 is causing a rise in temperature," which is absolutely false. And yet that story is propagated through the news, because the world has changed from being a rational you know, I wouldn't say creature, but thinking rationally to thinking irrationally, so that we can promote certain agendas, even at the expense of science, and refusing to listen to sound science.
By the way, there's a link in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com to an Epoch Times article, which contains a good deal of scientific analysis of CO2 and others based upon Patrick Moore's comments on Greenpeace. It all weaves together nicely and very informatively. So if you want to click on that link, you can take a look for yourself, because it's a pretty deep article. It talks about environmental apocalypse theories and the demonization of carbon dioxide, and how Greenpeace has basically morphed into a political organization from a group of protesters, and with a big budget, and allied with the United Nations, for example. They were a founding member of the environmental arm of the United Nations, and other organizations that are primarily political.
Well,
they're dedicated to fundraising. Yeah.
Yeah. All political at this point in time. And so, they're pushing this agenda. In fact, if you really look at it, you read that section in the article
Fox News article,
regard to the energy costing more. So everything has to cost more. Instead of doing what is reasonable in energy prices going down, you know, we had, prior to the current president, we had our energy prices coming down because we became energy independent for the first time in, you know, a long time, because we had sane energy policies. And we allowed the energy corporations and companies to do their thing, which is produce energy. And so now, with the current administration, we are shutting that part of this economy down. And what is it doing to energy prices? Well, everybody's feeling it. It is causing the energy prices to rise, and rise drastically. And the more of these windmills and the more of these solar panels you put in, the more you can guarantee that those energy prices are going to stay high, because, as you said, you still need to have reliable energy. And so you're building twice. And so in order to provide a constant power, rather than saying something like, okay, let's have a mix, a mix of energy, and let's throw nuclear energy back into the pot. And nuclear energy is far more efficient than any of these forms of energy, and by the way, far cleaner than any of these other forms of energy. But we're not doing that. The other form of energy which we should be looking at more is really a form of clean energy is natural gas, because natural gas burns cleanly. And it doesn't, you don't have the same problems as, for example, a coal-fired energy plant where you're burning coal, and then you have to, which we do here in this country, have all kinds of scrubbers on the smokestacks of these coal-fired plants to neutralize the sulfides or the sulfur compounds that might be, in the coal, or other compounds that might be environmentally detrimental. So even coal-fired plants are relatively clean today, these days, but natural gas is even cleaner.
I'm thinking it's so ironic that maybe this war in Ukraine has the beneficial effect of driving Europe back to coal and oil-based energy sources, as well as nuclear. I know in France, nuclear energy is the priority. And pulling us out of this strange politically induced insanity that we need only wind and solar. And I understand that if we let the market do what it does so efficiently here, those sources of energy, if they're reliable and if they're economical, will be developed. But to to go away from the proven ones is folly. Virginia talked about, the state of Virginia is talking about a nuclear initiative now, depending on how midterms go and how the state legislature goes, and they may just lead the way in this country for a rebirth, a rekindling of interest in nuclear energy. So a lot of those may be at least one of the results of this Ukraine war. And I hate the idea of the war altogether. It shouldn't have ever happened, but maybe there's some benefit to it.
Well, it may have woken up Europe to say, hey, you know, we were lazy and just using, you know, gas from fuel from Russia, and now that's all been cut off, and oh my gosh, what are we going to do? Has actually, as you say, stimulated them to look at more traditional forms of energy that, you know, they can better manage their energy supply and production. As opposed to relying on unreliable countries, you know. So I think that's, I would agree with you, that's a good thing. And the other thing, one of the things that we're seeing here, we have a fellow in our church home group, for example, he works in the in the natural gas production industry for excuse me, landfills. So you get natural gas out of landfills, and so here's a land, you know, here's a landfill that you're just, you know, throwing people's garbage into, but a lot of that landfill has organic matter. That organic matter then degrades, and the byproduct of the degradation of the organic matter in your landfill is natural gas. And so they tap into that natural gas, and then that can be used as, and they're using it as a form of natural gas energy. And they can't build these facilities fast enough. You know, they've got such a demand. And that's a good thing, because we're not wasting the energy that is coming out of these things. We're actually capturing it and then utilizing it as a clean form of energy.
That should be in the news. That should be all over the place. Part of the problem is an irresponsible press. I don't know how you fix that, because I don't trust social media to get it out. So what's left?
Well, it's news programs. You know, we're not a news station, we're a talk station, but you know, it's the alternative media. I mean, it's the that we have to learn to rely on for decent news. I mean, the current mainstream media is not doing journalism anymore. It's like we've produced generation or two of these. They call themselves journalists, but they don't do true investigative journalism to find out what the truth is. And if they find out what the truth is, then they can't publish it.
So. Yeah, get hounded out of the business. You know, there is at least one segment of America that is complaining of the carbon dioxide, that is the CO2 shortage. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Breweries are desperate. They can't carbonate beer anymore. It's supply chain, and there's a shortage of CO2. If they could like put a vacuum cleaner up into the atmosphere that would suck up CO2 for them, they could solve two problems at once. You think?
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm. Everything you taken know. Care of.
Yeah.
Fermentation does produce CO2. We produce CO2 when we're fermenting our wine. Yeah, we need to do is just capture that.
I think so. We're talking with Dr. Don Clark. Don, a member of the board at Creation Moments. You want to be aware of their website, creationmoments.com. And it's a great source for scientific information that establishes and supports and explains the biblical story of creation. And we often talk about that with Don, too, although we've been roped into discussions on COVID and vaccines and the energy so-called crisis. And we treat those things, too. And, Don, we appreciate your expertise in all those areas and look forward to the next conversation. We'll see you next Tuesday. Okay?
All righty. Well, you folks have a great, great week.
Don, thanks.
You too, Don.
Bye-bye.
Thanks much.
So long.